This is Dan Austin. This is a interview with Lou Burdett, who came up with the Yankee organization, later major pitcher with the Boston Braves and later with the Milwaukee Braves when they moved over there. The date is Wednesday, April the 24th, 1991. We're in the home of Lou Burdett in Sarasota, Florida. May I call you Lou?
Certainly.
Okay. Lou, you had mentioned just before we started recording that you had a little different introduction to baseball than most people. I guess you didn't play as a kid then.
Well, in Nitro, West Virginia, where I grew up.
Nitro?
Nitro, yeah. In Itiara.
Oh, the big chemical complex.
Chemical complex. No, it was powder plant in World War I. But we didn't have high school baseball. They had American Legion baseball, and I went out for American Legion ball, and they took my uniform away from me and gave it to someone else. So I didn't play any baseball until I was graduated from high school. And as went over to the plant where my parents, where my dad and my sister and my brother were, and I asked for a job, and they said, we're saving them for college ball players and all that come home for the summer. And I went back and told my dad that, and he said, well, why don't you try pitching? He said, you broke out all the windows in the house and all that stuff, throwing rocks. But anyway, I went out and tried out for the baseball team, and I ended up winning 12 and losing 2 in industrial ball. And it was the first time I'd played baseball. Except, you know, sandlot in the streets and all with the kids.
Yeah.
And then I went in the service, played 1 year of semi-pro ball, then went in the service, came out, and the Presbyterian minister asked me if I would like to go to the University of Richmond as a pitcher. And,
in Virginia.
In Virginia. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Richmond, Virginia, and so they paid my way over to see if I liked the school and all, and I went to school over there and played one spring over there, and won 12 and lost 2 of it. Beat Army, Navy, Duke, and University of Virginia twice, and all the teams that Coach Pitt at Richmond wanted to beat, but I was in well there, but they never gave me a penny as far as helping me.
No scholarship?
No scholarship at all. I had to get along on the $65 a month we got from the government.
Oh, the GI Bill of Rights?
And the GI Bill, yeah. And I went home to work one semester. You could do that back then, right after the war in 46. I went back home to work one semester and during the winter, and then go back to school in the spring. And for the last semester and play baseball again. So I got a telegram from Norfolk, Virginia. Tomato Face Dawson was his name.
Tomato Face Dawson?
That's what they called him. He was had a bright red face, but he owned the Norfolk Ball Club, which was a Yankee farm club, and asked me if I'd like to come down and try out with him. And I said, I don't think I want to go do that. And my older brother sent a telegram back and said I would come, and they sent me a ticket, so I went down to see if I liked the idea. And they offered me $175 a month and $500 if I was still in the organization in June of 15. I said my dad, I was 20 years old at the time, I said, my dad wouldn't let me play for a penny less than $200 a month. He said, okay, I guess if I said $300, it would have been all right.
Yeah.
But,
what class ball was that?
I went to, I pitched three games in Norfolk.
Uh-huh.
I won the first two. First one was a shutout, and I won the second one. And the third time I pitched, I lost by one run. I think it's 2-1 or 3-2, and they sent me they'd already had me sent out anyway to Amsterdam. And as long as I won, I guess I got to stay there. But once I lost the ball game, they sent me to Amsterdam, New York, in the Canadian American League. And that was the first, that was the first time I was in Hall at the Hall of Fame, because we went through there on the way to Three Rivers,
mm-hmm.
and from Amsterdam on the way to Three Rivers in Quebec.
The old bus route.
And the Braves, were playing, I don't know, some other team in the Hall of Fame game.
Mm-hmm.
So we sat out in right field there and as a team and watched them.
So that was about 1946?
It was the Yankees and the Braves playing.
Mm-hmm. Who was it?
1947. And then, I'm getting off.
No, no, this.
I'm getting off the Gideon baseball. But anyway, I played and played there for the rest of the season, and then I went to Quincy, Illinois, in the Free I League. And at that, we won the pennant and all of them. But as there were 19 guys on the team that year in Quincy. Yankees, we had a very strong farm system.
Mm-hmm.
22 farm clubs, I think, or 23. Yeah. And if you had a good year, you generally went up one grade. And I went from C to B. And then in Quincy, out of 19 guys that year in 48, in 1951, 3 years later, there were 14 of them in the big. That was a class B ball club.
That's kind of, all went up to the majors.
All went to the majors in 3 years.
Who were some of those players that went up with you then?
Oh, Lord, Marcus and Ernie Neville. I'm just trying to think of a bunch of them. Thomas. Pete Thomas.
Oh, he played for Kansas City briefly.
And, trying to think of Patterson. Patterson in center field, and there was 14 out of 19, because we were all talking about it at the time, and I just can't name all of them.
But
not very many of them stayed very long, but they were there.
At least they got their.
But then the next year, I went to Kansas City and played 2 years there. Mm-hmm.
That was in 49 and 50.
49
then.
And 50, and then. Went up with the Yankees in September.
Could I ask you before stop, and I say this because, as I told you, I grew up in Kansas City and was a member of the Knothole Gang, so we got in for a dime, I think, on Saturday afternoon. And that was a big ballpark.
Big ballpark.
350 down the lines and 450 straight away.
Down in the valley.
And that's a lot of real estate, so it kind of made it a good park for pitchers.
Well, they seem to go out of there anyway.
But if I remember correctly, I mean, here are you, a big, overpowering right-hander. Did real well, even though, it was on the way. There's AAA ball. Many of them were going on the way up. But that was a powerful ball that was played there at AAA there in the American Association.
Yeah, it was pretty good.
Because you probably played when Willie Mays was with the Minneapolis Millers before he went up with the Giants, mm-hmm. and lots of other players that at that time you met later in the big leagues.
Oh, Severs was in the league, and when Severs was in the 3I league, when I was there, Roy Severs.
Mm-hmm.
There was an awful lot of guys.
Hard
to remember. That's a long time ago.
When you were in AAA ball, you still traveled by train?
Yeah, by train.
By train. In those days, at least you didn't take the midnight bus out of town.
Well,
you played in good ballparks.
Mm-hmm.
I remember the old Minneapolis Miller ballpark. It was what they call it, the band box. It was about 250 down the right field line.
Right field line, yeah. That's the one that we even beat the fence to death, I guess. He didn't hit the ball high enough to hit it over, but he tried to hit it through it all.
but
there was an awful lot of good ball players in the association. And the next year, in 51, they sent me back to the Coast League.
Which league?
The Coast League.
Pacific Coast League. Okay.
So I had 3 years in AAA. But there wasn't much chance on the Yankee ball club at the time when they had Rashie Reynolds, Lopat Byrne, and Joe Page, and bunch of guys like that in the bullpen, and Whitey Ford comes up and wins 8 in a row from Kansas City, 50. And there just wasn't any place. And I think I got a good break when I got traded to the Boston Braves for Johnny Sane.
Yeah.
They wanted someone to help them right at the moment during the World Series, and they got Johnny Sane. And I got a break by going over to the other
there, and so the door opened for you by going to the Braves.
I finally got to go to the senior circuit, which is much better baseball than American.
Okay, that's for the record.
Yeah, I had to get that.
When you went up to the majors before Boston went to Milwaukee, then in the mid-50s, we had really four starting pitchers on a team was basically the most teams tried to have, four starting pitchers.
We never had four.
You never had four? You only had three.
Well, yes.
You had Warren Spahn.
Well, I'm talking about after 53.
Okay.
53 when we got to Milwaukee. Well, we had a bunch of guys, but we never did have the guy. I wasn't a starter. I was a relief pitcher. I started out as a relief pitcher in Boston, and when I went over to Boston, and I was a relief pitcher in the American Association for 2 years.
Uh-huh.
I became a starter in San Francisco, and won quite a few games as a starter. And then I went to I was a reliever in Boston, and I was a reliever in Milwaukee the first part of the year in 53 until Johnny Antonelli broke his finger.
Mm-hmm.
And Vern Bickford broke his finger, so I became a starter. And then I was a starter and a reliever in 1953. And I won 15 and lost 5 and had 29 saves, I think, which was also...
So you were pitching around 300 innings per year then?
I was pitching quite a few. Not that many right at that time, I don't think, but I had a lot of appearances. But I became when I became a starter then, I always relieved in between starts instead of throwing batting practice or throwing on the sidelines, uh-huh, because I'd much rather throw to a hitter.
Uh-huh.
So the manager would always, I'd go down the middle day in between starts, and if they needed somebody in late innings, they'd bring me in.
So you had that versatility.
Of course, saves back then didn't mean anything.
That's right. Now they're going back and looking at the records, trying to figure out,
I don't even know if they kept them that
No,
way.
They didn't. They didn't. I don't think they kept them up until maybe 20 years ago.
They certainly didn't mean that much.
No.
Well,
they didn't have really many middle...
Most guys went 9 innings or tried to back then, but then...
If you didn't, you didn't earn your board and keep.
That's right. The long man in the bullpen was just a necessity on the ball club. He wasn't rated as very much.
Yeah.
But now they've got all kinds of specialists, so it's a different game.
You think they'll ever go back to 3 or 4 starters on a team? Today they have about 5.
I don't think they will. I don't know.
And it's been about,
I don't know that most of the pitchers have the stamina to pitch 9 innings regularly. Especially every fourth day, because we were schooled that way. These boys nowadays, young fellas, they haven't been doing that. And I think you have to do something in order to build.
You have to do it for years. You don't just start on it the year after next.
I don't think you could. They would. I think they would train a little different. I know they train awful hard now with weights and all that stuff. But we never touched weights when we were pitching. We were afraid we would get muscles that we didn't need.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
I know I swung an axe and a sledgehammer building a miniature railroad in Lake Wales, Florida in the winter of 52, right before we switched to Milwaukee.
Mm-hmm.
And I know I came to spring training with that I'd build up muscles in my biceps and all to where I couldn't throw 60 feet.
I just rear back
and throw, and the ball would not go anywhere. I had built up muscles that worked against my throwing muscle. And all spring training, I threw every day and finally broke it down. Tears just pouring out of your eyes. I mean, you couldn't throw. So I definitely quit swinging an axe or sledgehammer.
In those days, in the up until at least the early, late 50s, you really didn't have all the coaches that you have today. Oh, yeah, there was a hitting coach and a batting coach and a, and
well, we
a
had
pitching coach, but not as many as I see today that's on the major league roster. Were any, can you point out anyone when you went up to the majors that helped you improve the art of pitching?
I think Bucky Walters helped me more than anyone.
Who later became manager of the Washington Senators?
Yeah, Bucky Walters, the pitcher for Cincinnati.
Uh-huh. What did he teach you that you didn't know before?
Well, he was trying to get me, he threw about three quarters the same as I did when he pitched. And he was just telling me to keep the ball down and work it in and out. And when you come up, you come in. You don't throw up and away because I could hit that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's definitely a way to pitch. Is don't throw the ball up and away from anyone unless maybe you sneak a 95 mile an hour fastball or something once in a while. But even if you do it consistently, they can gear up and hit that fastball.
Yeah.
You've got to have other things to go with it.
Yeah. You got to have, if you're going to have only a fastball, better have a lot of hop on it because they'll belt you.
Even if you've got hop on it, I mean, I hit three home runs off of Sandy Koufax.
You did?
Yes. All by one win, won all three games by one run. Not many people know that.
No, I tell you, no. Maybe so at Sandy Koufax, maybe he remembers.
He knows.
So Bucky Walters showed you how to place the ball around the plate.
How to pitch the ball, mm-hmm. how to keep the ball in and out. I mean, he just told me you're a sinker slider pitcher. One is for the outside of the plate, one's for the inside of the plate. So keep it there. You miss down.
Uh-huh.
Don't miss up. And if you come up, come in. Come in on the fist. Come in on the fist.
Yes.
And a change of speed. I mean, he also brought that up, that that's a very important question.
I've heard that baseball defined as the game of consistency, whether it be an umpire, a pitcher, an outfielder.
Definitely. Yes.
Be consistent.
That's true. If you consistently throw the ball around the plate, the umpire will give you the benefit of the doubt.
If you think he favors a veteran over a rookie?
No, I wouldn't think so. No, not particularly.
But if he sees you,
if the umpire behind the plate doesn't have to jump around all over the place, getting out of the way of low pitches and high pitches and stuff like that, I think he will call a much more consistent ball game for you.
Mm-hmm.
He will be more consistent also, which is what we're talking about, consistency.
Yeah, that's right. I heard the expression chin music. Now, Early Win.
Was the meanest pitcher in the American League, and I was the meanest in the National League.
Well, I wasn't going to say that. But since you brought it up.
And we're very good
friends. The brushback versus the bean.
And we're very good friends.
Yeah. But I heard the expression a little bit of chin music because even though that batter says, hey, this is my territory, there's a little bit of area of maybe 6 inches or so that says no trespassing.
As long as he's standing in the batter's box, you don't bother him too much. But when he tries to go out after something that he really shouldn't be able to reach, then you've got to back him up.
They've got to back him up.
That's the way
so he doesn't plant his feet.
Wasn't planning his feet as much as it was just keeping him guessing as whether you're going to come in or out, really.
Uh-huh.
But it was chin music.
Uh-huh. And any particular batters that went out after some of those pitches and you got had to keep them honest?
There's an awful lot of them.
Some
guys like Dick Groton and Clemente and guys that hit the ball to the opposite field. Consistent.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have to keep them honest by keeping mm-hmm. them away,
yeah.
back them up just a little bit. In fact, I broke Dick Rowe's wrist with a ball that was, I still think it was a strike.
Yeah. Beg your pardon?
I still think the ball was a strike. It was on the inside part
on
of
the corner,
plate.
But he had
but
his body.
He had his front shoulder down, going out, going to the right field, and hit him on the wrist. He swung at the ball.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up about that, but I heard that about you in early win in terms of keeping the batters loose at the plate and not getting too much of the pitcher's territory. Did you have any favorite pitch, one that you preferred over another that the catcher tried to say, hey, let's not do that too often there? But did you have a favorite pitch, fastball, slider,
I do sinker slider, fastball, three-quarter sidearm fastball that sunk. Mm-hmm. I held the ball with the seams. It sunk down and into a right-hander, and the slider went low and away. So I threw both of them and threw them both with pretty good strikes generally on the outside and the inside corner and a variation of speeds. I also threw a screwball, and I was always accused of throwing a spitball after, I'm sure that's what you wanted me to talk about.
Well, it was going to come up later.
I'm sure it was. But I got more.
Or do you want to say anything for the record on that?
I got more pleasure out of being accused of throwing a spitball, I think, than anything else, except the actual win of a pitching a ball game. Because hitters are such egotistical people that they think if they get any excuse to use when they make an out, well, they're going to jump on it and they're going to use it every time they make an out. Doesn't make any difference. It's funny. Once I was accused of throwing a spitball and I started going through some motions out there to enhance the thought that I did, and I don't care what pitch I threw, whether it was a screwball, a changeup, a slider, a sinker, or whatever, and if they hit the ball, just hit the dickens out of the ball right at the center fielder or something, and they would come by the mound going to the third base dugout, and I said, hey, you got all that one. You're like, shut up, you cheating so-and-so, you know. And they're just looking, they all look for an excuse when they make an out, because mm-hmm. I sat on the bench when my hitters came back. Mm-hmm. And they always came back. If there was any excuse at all, they could blame that pitcher for cheating or something.
Yeah.
Every one of my hitters would do it too.
Yeah.
They think the pitcher is a necessary evil, and there's no way a normal pitcher can get them out.
Mm-hmm.
They have to cheat or do something. Now, that's what I was talking about, the spitball. I don't think I've ever had any more fun than to see grown men cry and complain about something that didn't happen. When it was just making an excuse for their own shortcut.
Yeah. I heard Billy Williams, who retired a couple of years ago in National League umpire, mm-hmm. that he would say, boy, he had more pitcher or more batters complain. They're greasing the ball. Got a greaser.
Mm-hmm.
He scratched, nicked the ball and got a little bit of dirt in it, you know, when he picked up the rosin bag. And
even if a guy did that once in a while, they couldn't possibly do it as many times as they're accused of doing it, because the umpire would catch him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's that simple.
Yeah.
But every hitter complained about it. Every hitter used the same excuse in the same ballgame.
Question, Lou. How some pitchers get a reputation, and their record shows it, that they have another club that's their kissing cousin. I mean, they could go out and they could beat them even when their stuff is mediocre. Now, Bob Buell, who was...
Beat the Dodgers.
Huh?
Could beat the Dodgers.
Yeah. In 1956, he beat them 8 out of 9 times.
I know he did.
And you lost the pennant there, right there in the closing day or 2 days. You were, well,
yeah, we
but
lost,
that year.
We lost the pennant that year because they didn't pitch me on Friday.
We'll come to that too then. Let me ask you, what, did you have a club that was your kissing cousin that just seems like no matter whether you had some good stuff or not?
Well, the Giants didn't beat me much. I went for 5.5 years once without losing to them. The Giants were a good ball club for me to pitch against. I don't know, I just had good luck.
Well, it had to be more than just good luck.
No, I don't think it was.
Didn't you feel it in your head when you went out to the ballpark that day?
I don't know. I could beat Brooklyn in Brooklyn, and I could beat the Dodgers in their ballpark, but I could not beat them in Milwaukee. because our hitters didn't score many runs over there pitching in Milwaukee for some reason.
Oh.
And you had to generally pitch a good ball game in Milwaukee, really good ball game, in order to beat the Dodgers, because we didn't score many runs. And I don't know why. Off of their pitch. And we get in their ballpark, and our guys just bang the ball all over the place.
Mm-hmm. So you think really it's just pure luck?
Dan, I couldn't put finger on it, but it happened. I don't know why.
Okay.
And Bon and I beat Cincinnati. Buell couldn't beat Cincinnati.
They were just mediocre club in those days.
Well, they had tremendous hitting.
Yeah.
That's when they hit.
Oh, Ted Kluszewski and
hit
some
220 of them. Some home runs to tie the Giants, but they didn't win. But we beat them, I think we beat them 20 out of 22 times that year. The Braves did.
Okay. Let me hear a story about the 56. You said they didn't pitch you on Friday.
Our manager, Fred Haney, was the greatest man I ever played baseball for, and one of the nicest people. But he was thinking that if it ended up tied, that he would like to have Buell to pitch the first game of the three-game playoff, two out of three.
Yeah.
So therefore, he put Buell in the pitch on Friday night against St. Louis. And I didn't have as much trouble beating St. Louis at that particular time. And Buell got beat. Then Spahn pitched Saturday night and got beaten 11 or 12 innings by Herm Wiedmeyer, who he'd never beat us, I don't think, in 5 years. But anyway, we lost the ball game. And I pitched my ball game on Sunday morning. But had I pitched by regular turn, I think we probably would have won.
There wouldn't have been a perfect game by Don Larson in the World Series.
At least we would have had a
tie. And then you could have gone into the 2 out of 3 playoff.
Well, you never know. Larson might have pitched against us.
Well, that's all. I'm going to ask you. Of course, we'll get to the World Series of 57 and 58 when you played the Yankees and took the 1-57. But I'm going to go back, and you may bring this up in answering this question. Can you think of any game or any particular inning of a game where you were at your best? It was your peak performance, that everything was just... You were in the groove, and you remember it after some 33 years later or 35 years later as representative of the best game that you ever pitched. Can you think of where that was your peak performance, and it just sticks in your mind?
No, my games, I pitched a no-hitter, which is a great thrill.
Mm-hmm.
And I pitched several one-hitters. I guess the most fun I ever had in a ball game, mentally, was when Charlie White was catching me in a black catcher we had, and I'd never pitched to him in a ball game, was catching me in New York. I mean, in Yankee Stadium, not Yankee Stadium, but in Brooklyn, Ebbets Field. And I didn't even throw a curveball very. I didn't average 2 curveballs a ball game.
Mm-hmm.
And he's coming down with 2 fingers all the time for a curveball, and I'm throwing them. I mean, I don't want to make Charlie make him feel bad, and I'm throwing curveballs. In the fifth inning, I think it was, I got a no-hitter going. In the fifth inning, I think I tried to quick pitch Gil Hodges, and he hit the ball just barely into the center field bleachers in Ebbets Field, just a line drive, right? Bing! I tried to quick pitch him, and he just cow-tailed it. And that's the only hit they got. But the rest of the time, I was throwing changeups and curveballs, and it was something I'd never done in a ball game before, but I really got a kick out of it. I won the ball game. It was 3-1 or something like that.
So you're literally experimenting.
But it was only a one-hitter. It was a one-hitter. But it's the only ball game I ever did that.
Never did it after that.
I threw Willie Mays a curveball one time right down the middle with two strikes, and he said, "What was that? What was that?" And he said, "You don't have one." Willie was funny. "You don't have one." And he took it for a third strike. He said, "You don't have one."
He was muttering all the way back to his dugout, wasn't he?
That's a crazy game, man. I think the thing I miss more about being out of baseball is the one-on-one confrontation between the hitter and the pitcher. I mean, I miss that more than anything else.
Well, you know, that makes baseball a unique sport. All the other sports, you know, like basketball, soccer, football, it's rarely one-on-one. So maybe a forward being basketball.
You're guarding each other, but still not one-on-one. You do have
but only baseball has really that feature. Nobody can up there to help you.
That's right. You're the one that starts everything going.
That's right. And the other thing is that baseball, you know, is the only sport where the defense has control of the ball.
Right. That's true.
And so in that sense, it evens out. But that's what you miss the most, that confrontation. And
one-on-one between one-on-one. Standing on the mound trying to figure what pitch would be the best to throw next. I mean,
okay, you gave the one of Willie Mays, and when he said, "Hey, Lou Burdett didn't have that," where'd he come up with that? Any other, you had to face Stan Musial. He had a pretty good eye.
Oh, Stan was good here. If you got Stan out with a pitch in the first inning, don't throw it again the rest of the ball game because he's waiting for it. I always remember that. I threw him a screwball and struck him out. And I thought that was the first time up, and the third time up I threw him another screwball, and he like tore the left field fence down. I mean, he hit line drive right against the fence, right down the line. But he was waiting for it. I mean, you could just see he was waiting for it. But what made Stan a great hitter was the fact that he hit the ball where it's pitched. And didn't try to pull a pitch when it was in the wrong place.
Mm-hmm.
He would go with the pitch and hit it with authority. Yeah. That's the way Aaron was until he started trying to beat Matthews out of the home run deal and ended up hitting more home runs than anybody else.
That's right. When he started, came up that...
he would have been the next 400 hitter.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, until he went into the home run.
Aaron was strictly a line drive hitter when he first came in. Yeah. I mean, with authority. Wherever it was pitched, he just ping. I had the pleasure of playing with a lot of good ball players.
Yes, you did. With and against.
Not only on. Yes. Well, I still think they talk about different eras of baseball, but I think the middle 50s. Middle 50s, gone up to 60 or so, was 62 or 63 was probably the best era of baseball.
Well, it's never thought, you know, you always think about the golden age of sports in the 20s with Murderer's Row of the Yankees and then Bill.
Well, no doubt they were a good ball club, but they were only one good ball club out of the whole league.
Yeah, that's true. You usually had the Giants in the National League and the Yankees in the American.
Well, I was talking about overall. All 8 teams in each league, there were no patches really in the middle 50s. I think everybody had good ball players. Whoever got the most consistent pitching was the winner.
That's the winner. Question. Let's say that I'm just an average fan. I take the family out, go to maybe 3 or 4 ball games a year. And I decide to watch Lou Burdett pitch for the Milwaukee Braves, and I want to know something about pitching. So what would be your guide to an average baseball fan in watching a pitcher and not focus on the outfield or the third baseman or all the signs that the third base coach throws up the line or the batter, but Dan Austin is just going to watch Lou Burdett pitch for 3 innings and try to forget about everybody else. Now, What advice would you give me, an average baseball fan, to look for, to see how Lou Burdette is pitching? Mannerisms?
That's a tough question, isn't it? Because according to where you're sitting in the ballpark.
I'm sitting in the ballpark. I'm going to sit around by the first base side. I'll take third base side because then I can, you're a right-hander, so I'm going to watch you from that side. So I'll be behind the third base dugout.
I think you have to watch to see the number of strikes that you throw and how close you come to the catcher's mitt on every pitch, because the catcher is holding the mitt where he wants the pitch generally.
Mm-hmm.
And you can tell whether a guy has, you can tell from the side whether he has good velocity or not, and whether he's fooling the hitter at all. But I think that probably you could watch the catcher's mitt and see how, if he had to move it very much.
Okay, how much he...
And then whether the hitter walked back to the dugout or whether he's on first, second, or third, you tell real quick.
That's right, tell real quick then. But is it anything to do with shaking off so many signs from the catcher?
Shaking off?
Uh-huh. Yeah, you find real early in the game that
I never
really has no indication about how well you're going to pitch.
No. I never shook catchers off. Not at all. Very soon. I saw the pitch they wanted where I wanted to throw it. So that's the only difference.
Oh. So you didn't shake off many signs?
You can't. Well, you don't fool the catcher that way. When you start shaking off and all that stuff, once in a while in a tough situation, he may not catch your shake off or your switch or whatever you're giving, and you throw a wild pitch and lose the ball game with a man on third base.
Yeah.
I've seen it done so many times with trying to outsmart the game of baseball. Mm-hmm. That's what I call it.
Yeah.
Was trying to outsmart
the game. Forgetting about common sense.
Yeah. Just go out there and get him out, then you don't have to worry about it.
The Braves in the 50s had some power hitters. I call it the lumber company. Joe Adcock, who played first base, if I remember correctly.
Mm-hmm.
You had Sid Gordman. I think he was infielder.
Who?
Sid Gordon.
Sid Gordon, he was an outfielder.
Outfield.
Yes.
But you had Eddie Matthews.
He was only with us 1 year in Milwaukee.
You had Eddie Matthews, right. Andy Papko, Bill Bruton, Hank Aaron.
Billy Bruton, Hank Aaron, and Wes Covington. We had some pretty good...
I mean, you had some power hitters on that.
Very good power hitters. We had good power hitters.
Pitchers? Well, you had Lou Burdette.
Well,
you had Gene Conley.
Bond, Buell, and Burdette were the three starters. And then we had Willie, Conley, and Joe Jay that alternated in the fourth spot.
Uh-huh.
And then... Bob Rush came over from the Cubs and was the fourth starter and doing well. But he went in and asked Haney, he said, I'd like to pitch every fifth day instead of every fourth day. And Haney said, if you think I'm going to foul up my other three pitchers, let you pitch every fifth day, you're back in the bullpen again.
You have great admiration for Haney.
Yes, definitely.
What did you do about working with ball players that earned that respect? Was he a good listener, or was he just good baseball smarts?
I think he left ball players alone more than anything else. Gave you a pat on the back when you deserved it, kicking the fanny when you didn't. Uh-huh.
Didn't do much talking on the bench then during the game?
Well, he talked considerably. He never had many meetings. Just go out and do the job. But he told you when you did something wrong.
So he was pretty blunt about that.
Yeah.
As well as when you did something well.
True. He was, he just seemed to get the most out of his players. And that's what a manager is all about.
Yeah.
A lot of managers will win 5 games a year by making a real intelligent decision at the right time and maybe lose 8 to 10 with bad decisions. Mm-hmm. So it, managing Stengel proved that you have to have a good team in order to win. When he left the Yankees and went to the Mets. I mean,
yeah. Found out real quick, like.
It's just common sense that the manager is only as good as the team he has. Now, like I was talking about Haney, if it's a type of man that can get the most out of his ball player, then he, chances are he'll be a winner. Mm-hmm. And doesn't try to outsmart the game.
Did you ever think about managing?
By trying to make, trying to get 24, 25 guys in the lineup every game by me, by the manager making his moves. Uh-huh. No, I never thought about managing.
Didn't interest you in a bit. What about pitching coach?
I was pitching coach for Atlanta Braves. Uh-huh. And I enjoyed it. But at the time, it didn't pay much. And by the time I moved my family to Atlanta for the summer, I think we broke even.
I don't know
but
about
I got another year in the pension
plan. Another year in pension plan. I guess... I don't know what batting and hitching or hitting and pitching coaches get, but
at the time I was, I'll tell you the truth, there's 72 and 73 in Atlanta. I was the highest paid coach on the team, making $16,500, which is not a lot of money.
No, it isn't. Not when you're moving a family around the countryside.
Not when your coaching guys are making $1 million, even then. Or close to.
Yeah, I was thinking about, you know, when they settled the umpire strike here opening day, and I think beginning umpire will, in the majors, will get maybe 50 or 60 grand, and I think the top is 175, and then I look at a rookie, major leaguer, and I think the minimum is 100 grand now.
110.
110?
100, 110. Yeah, that's quite a difference.
I'd like to go back to that 56 season. Your record was 19-11. You led the National League in ERA with a 2.7, and you had 6 shutouts. Damn good record.
I still didn't win 20, though. You know, you're 19 wins is like hitting .299. You're not a 300 hitter. You're not a 20-game winner.
You ever think it made that much difference when it came to the salary negotiations, whether it was 19 or 20?
Makes all the difference in the world. But actually, what we got paid on in my day was the difference between over games over 500. Like if you're 12-12, you're so-and-so. But if you're 10 games over, 8-10 games over or better, over 500, then you get maximum raise.
Yeah.
And a maximum raise back then was about $10,000. Because that's what I got.
That's what you got, $10,000 raise, which might, in today's terms, be around $35,000, maybe $40,000 most.
It'd be $100,000. Mm-hmm. 10 times as much. Cost of living gone up at least 10 times.
Yeah. After coming in second place in 1956, the Braves came back in 57, won the pennant, went on to win the World Series. And I think in the World Series, Yankees won, what, the first two games?
Won the first game.
First game. And then you came up.
I won the second game.
And you won the second game. I heard about a play. I think it's called the shoe polish play.
Oh, Nippy Dunn.
Uh-huh. And hit batsman.
That was
and
in the fourth game.
Was that in the fourth game? What was that? The umpire called it a strike or something?
Well,
or a ball?
The umpire called it a ball, and Nippy Dunn started to run to first base, and the umpire said, no, come on back, that was a ball. And he said, it hit me on the foot and went. And the ball came back to the umpire, and the umpire looked at it, and here was the black shoe polish. On there, and he let him go to first base. All it did was put a man on base, and Matthews hit a home run.
I think Tommy Byrne was...
Logan, either that or Logan hit a double. And
I think Logan came up to bat and got a hit.
Double down the left field.
Uh-huh. But I remember Tommy Byrne was pitching at that time. And, of course, he came up with the Yankees. And I remember when he pitched for the Yankees in 47. And it would be the longest ball game because he would put a 3-2 count on everybody.
Everybody. He had 3-2 on everybody.
You know, bases loaded, no out, and then strike out three. And I remember Steve Suchok said, you know, by the end of the second evening, he was dead tired.
Mm-hmm. Well, nobody liked to be back on their heels like that.
No, yeah, and that's what happened. You had to do that for, you'd have 100 pitches by the end of the fourth inning. Mm-hmm. And so you got a World Series ring in 57.
Mm-hmm.
A good raise.
Well, I won
World champion.
I won the second, the fifth, and the seventh game.
Uh-huh. World Series hero. And
showed up.
Did you go
the tough game was the fifth game. My pitching against Whitey, it was nothing. I think in the fifth inning or sixth inning, Jerry Coleman backed up on a ground ball hit by Matthews, and Matthews beat it out, which was the turning point of the ball game.
Mm-hmm.
And butted Matthews over. We walked there and what is it? And Adcock, hit the single up the middle and scored the winning run.
Yeah.
Scored the one run, which we wouldn't have, probably may not have got a run off of Whitey had Jerry Coleman not backed up on the ball.
This is side two of tape number one, interview with Lou Burdett. How'd you pitch to Mickey Mantle?
I threw batting practice to Mickey when he tried out for the Yankees game.
In 1950?
Yeah, Ralph Houck was catching and I was pitching. He was giving signs and wasn't telling them what he and Moosecow and what was coming.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. But I knew a little bit about Mickey. I'd never played with him.
Mm-hmm.
And in But I just pitched my own game. Well, with the scouting report we got on the Yankees, Spahn and I laid up the room laughing about the scouting report. We couldn't pitch. I mean, we can't pitch against the Yankees, we were saying.
Yeah, that's right.
We can't pitch against the Yankees. We don't have a high fastball and a low drop. And a low curveball. So we can't pitch.